I have the 7, 8, and 9 assignments up now. You will have until a week from Wednesday to do the chapter 7 assignment. We're going to finish chapter 7 today, so I'll give you a week at least to get that one done. Get started on that one soon while this stuff is fresh in your mind. We're going to do calculations today. That'll be a lot like the ones in that assignment, so I'd recommend getting those out of the way as soon as you can. So a couple of them are due Wednesday. Remember, they're still due at 11:59 p.m., so next Wednesday night, a week from Wednesday. Okay. That's about it. We're starting our lab projects today. You guys have a report that's due today. Other questions? Yeah.
Is that a typo, or do we have two homework assignments due 2 days apart?
Nope, that's correct. So I'll encourage you. I do that to give you plenty of time to work on it, but you should not be starting the Chapter 9 assignment after Wednesday, December 2nd, in other words. So we'll talk more about that as we go along. I do that, though, because our third exam is on the Monday following this Friday. All right. At the end of last time, we were starting to talk about the weird stuff involving quantum mechanics. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle up there. Remember, that strange-looking equation, all that tells us is that the more accurately we know where an electron is, the less accurately we know where it's going, and vice versa. The more accurately we know what direction an electron is traveling or something like that, the less accurately we're able to pinpoint its exact location. So, and that could be demonstrated very precisely by that weird experiment I showed you a picture of last time, where a stream of electrons goes through those two slits. Normally, it has a interference pattern, so it's got the it sort of looks like zebra stripes, making this big pattern, which corresponds to it behaving as waves. But if you shine an electron beam in the path, or a laser beam in the path of those electrons, there are ways that you can detect where an individual electron would strike that beam. And in that case, instead of getting that interference pattern, you get two straight shots of electrons, just like they had been particles flying through those slits like that. So because of that laser beam in the path, we would know exactly where an electron was, but we wouldn't be able to tell as well where it's going and so on. So that's those two parts correlate to the particle-like nature and the wave-like nature of any kind of small particle. So I don't expect you to have any more of an advanced understanding of it than that, just understanding that they're the two qualities of anything small, like electrons or photons or something like that. And the more we know about one, the less we know about the other, for instance. So it may seem like our hands are a bit tied when we're talking about the behavior of electrons and particles like that. But rather than talking about any one individual electron, where it is or where it's going at any certain point in time.
Schrodinger's cat? Yeah, that's that whole big thought experiment about... I don't know. I'd have to read that again. But something about not knowing what's inside the box. About how... I think it's how if the box is closed, only if the box is open can you know what's inside of it or something. It's almost a philosophical argument as much as something in terms of quantum mechanics. But part of it is the observer effect too, where any measurement you make on something very small, that measurement by necessity changes the actual thing that you're measuring. So there's no way to get an accurate measurement of where an electron is or all the properties of an electron, because any measurement you would make
would involve shining some kind of energy at it, and that would change the electron. So that's the observer effect that's related to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, but a separate idea. So rather than talk about any one individual electron, where it happens to be at any point in time, we're going to use probabilities to talk about what region an electron or a series of electrons is likely to occupy. And there's a higher and higher probability that that electron could occupy this certain region, maybe. And as you get further out, there's less and less probability that that you find an electron there, for instance. What we can do, a wave function, and we're not going to talk much about this other than just me showing you the symbols here, but that Greek psi, it looks like a trident, right? The wave function is a mathematical equation that describes the wave-like properties of an atom. So remember I talked about how there can be different sets of standing waves? I compared it to a jump rope that's tied, if you imagine tying a jump rope to the wall. You can have one big wave going up and down, but if you go faster, you can have two waves, right, going like that. And if you go faster, you can have three waves and four waves, but there's no 2.5 waves, and there's no 3 3/4 waves. Okay? It's those whole numbers of full waves that can stand between one point and another point. Okay? So electrons have those similar wave-like properties, and a wave function is just an equation that describes those wave-like properties. So the higher in energy an electron is, the more of those waves can sort of fit around an atom or within a certain space. So quantum numbers then are four variables in the wave function that combined describe a single electron. So a wave function itself is a very complicated equation. It's different for every atom. Okay? We'll talk a little bit about hydrogen's equation because it's the simplest. But based on those quantum numbers, depending on these different numbers that you plug into it, you can be describing the behavior of different electrons. So with all four of those quantum numbers, you can describe as accurately as we know about it the behavior of one electron. That's not saying where it is at one point in time, but rather where it is most likely to be, what area it's most likely to occupy, for instance. Okay? So an orbital, then, is what I was talking about there. An orbital is a solution to the wave function with a certain combination of quantum numbers, a three-dimensional volume inside of which an electron is likely to be found. So these are equations that we won't do. They're very complicated. Okay? But the wave function is the equation. Quantum numbers are the variables in that equation. So you can change those variables. And the solution you get out of that is an orbital. So the equation will actually describe the three-dimensional shape of this region inside of which electrons are likely to be found. And some have different shapes, some have different sizes, and so on. But that's the best way that we have now to describe the actual behavior of electrons. So electrons do not just circle in concentric rings outside the nucleus like planets do around the sun. It was a decent model for understanding that electrons can only have certain energies to them, but the orbitals are the truest description that we know of now. Okay? Using quantum mechanics, using quantum theory, that's how we can describe electrons. Probably in 100 years there will be a new, better theory that will let us describe with more precision the behavior of an electron, but this is where we're at right now. So let's start with the first, probably the most important quantum number. Remember, the quantum numbers are the variables in that wave function. So the principal quantum number is the one that I think really has the most effect on the properties of an electron. So it's called n, okay, lowercase n, so don't confuse it with the variable for number of moles. N, when it's a quantum number, it's the principal quantum number. So it's a integer, right? The lowest value of n is 1, and it goes up from there to infinity. Right? It determines the overall size and energy Yes, if I could actually draw here. That's working on it. Size and energy of an orbital. So they're related to each other. So where n equals 1, okay, that's the lowest energy. So what, I just can't draw? That's okay, right? You guys don't need my handwriting. Whoa, there it is. Just had to catch up. All right. So. So I'll write something, then we'll stand around and we'll wait for it to appear after a few minutes. All right. Well, let's just talk about it. N equals 1, the smallest of a set of orbitals. Okay? As we increase the number, the orbitals get larger and they get higher in energy. So I can scroll just fine. I just can't write. Let's close it up, open it back up again. Doing too much in the background. Gotta love Windows XP. Alright. There, I can at least do stuff. Alright. Well, let's expand it, see if it still works. Hey, alright. So, n equals 1. Smallest and lowest energy, sort of works. The energy of an electron in a hydrogen atom. So hydrogen is the smallest of the elements. Okay? A hydrogen atom just has one proton and one electron. So the wave function, right, for a hydrogen atom, at least the part of it where we calculate its energy, there are lots of versions of a wave function. Some of them give a space, some of them give an energy, and so on. So the wave function that calculates energy, it only depends on n. That's it. We don't need the other quantum numbers to calculate the energy of an electron in a hydrogen atom. So here's the equation. Okay. Let's take a look at this little graph here that can hopefully help us understand how this works. How is it that, and you got to think about negative numbers and negative exponents. Which of these has the highest energy? N equals 1 or N equals 4, shown on here? N equals 4 does. Well, you can tell sort of by the graph here, but look at the number. Okay, I mean, if I stay within this negative 10 to the negative 19, negative 5, negative 2, negative 1, if this energy increases and increases and increases, what value will this approach? Zero. That's right. It doesn't approach infinity. It approaches zero. Okay. So that's how that works. That's why n or n squared here is on the bottom of this fraction. As n gets larger, we're going to end up dividing by a larger number, which makes a smaller negative number, which brings it up closer to zero. So just remember, higher n, closer to zero in energy from the negative side. Okay? So this one is still the higher energy here. Change in energy is just like any other delta. So when an electron is making a transition, like we talked about last time, where it's either jumping up to a higher energy level or dropping down to a lower energy level, we can calculate the change in energy for that transition. Okay? So if this is the energy at any one of those particular energy levels that an electron can have, delta E is just a delta between those. Since this is a constant that's multiplied by those, we can simplify that a little bit to say that delta E is negative 2.18 10 to the minus 18 joules times 1 over n squared final minus 1 over n squared initial. Okay. That was just taking this one, subtracting another one from it, and then factoring out this constant in front of it, like that. Okay. So this is an equation we can use to show the change in energy of an electron in a transition. Now, I also say down here that the energy of a photon is equal to negative delta E of an electron. What do you suppose that means? What happens when one electron goes from a high energy level to a low energy level? Let's say it drops from 4 to 3 or 4 to 2. What will happen? Yeah, light is emitted. That energy, if I have one electron dropping down, there is one what given off? Yeah, one photon given off. So why is there a sign change in there? So if I'm dropping an energy from 4 to 2, what will be the sign of delta E? If I go from high energy to low energy, what's the sign of delta E? Negative, right? Yeah, it's negative because I'm going down in energy because I had more energy to start. So I go down in energy, I give off a photon that has a certain amount of energy to it. Okay? That's why. So if the electron decreases in its energy, that same energy is given off in a photon. Okay? Energy is conserved overall. If a photon is absorbed, that will promote an electron up in energy. So the signs of those are opposite of each other. That's right. Photons are... Well, there is a relationship between mass and energy. L equals mc squared. There's that sort of thing. So photons are... I believe photons are massless as far as we know. The interesting thing about the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland is that one of the things that they hope to discover from those from the experiments there is the particle that imparts mass on other particles. So the Higgs boson, they call it, and hopefully they're looking to have experimental evidence that shows that the Higgs field is what actually gives things mass. So certain subatomic particles have mass and certain do not have mass. So electrons have a small amount of mass, protons and neutrons have a large amount of mass relatively. Photons do not have mass, I believe, and there are lots of other particles in there, some with mass and some that don't. So the interaction of those particles with this Higgs field is what they hoped, is one of the main things they hope to discover at that Large Hadron Collider. So what we can do with these equations here, we should be able to calculate how much energy is changing in a certain transition, and therefore how much energy is given off by a photon for any of these transitions. So let's just remind ourselves, if I start out in n equals 1, what would have to happen to that electron in order for it to hop up to n equals 2? Yeah, has to have energy absorbed. Okay. It would be promoted to n equals 2. If it were to drop back down to n equals 1, it would release one photon. Which would release a higher energy photon, 2-to-1 or 3-to-1? This is a bigger jump downwards, right? 3-to-1 is. That's a larger delta E. Okay, go ahead. If you have metal and you're shining some light on some metal, so like the photoelectric effect, there are certain semiconductors that when light is shined on them, they will absorb an electron and then energy, current, will flow through it. Yeah, that's the photoelectric effect. When we've got absorbing and releasing, that's like in those gas lamps that we had, where I have a gas sample and I plug high voltage electricity up to it, that provides the energy in to those electrons, so they're promoted. Then they drop back down and release photons that you can see. So just those metals that absorb photons, they release their energy just by a current that runs through them. Okay. So this is more like in those gas samples. So, here's a calculation that we should be able to do. Calculate the energy. All right, with our equation here, we can calculate energy pretty easily. Energy and wavelength in nanometers of a photon emitted when an electron in a hydrogen atom. Okay, this equation only works with hydrogen because hydrogen is the only element where energy only depends on this one quantum number. Okay? So, we do a transition from n equals 3 to n equals 2. Okay? Some amount of energy will be given off. So calculate that energy in joules that this constant has here. Okay? When you get an energy, calculate a wavelength. Okay? The other equation that we said before, E equals hc over lambda, we'll help with that. That's the equation that spans the particle and wave-like functions of an electron. Okay? So start with the green equation up on top. Okay? See if you can calculate delta E. You know what to do then to go from delta E to energy of a photon. That's what I'm interested in. So see if you can get the same energy as someone around you. Once you confirm that, then see if you can get wavelength in nanometers. Yes.
No, it's always, if one electron drops, it gives out one photon. But that photon can have higher energy.
Yep, he's the one in green up there. That gives you the same thing. We just won't always have those energies. So practice plugging it into that equation. Yeah, you're right on that graph. It does actually list those energies. You can subtract those to check your answer, if you want. But you're not going to have those energies. Use this equation to figure out the change in energy.
So
No, the electrons, all they do is absorb energy and drop down. Absorb energy and drop down. As long as you supply energy in, they'll keep absorbing it and releasing it, as long as you have the switch on. So, the photons are given off when they come in your eye, and that's what you see as the light. A photon is a little packet of energy. If you have a neon lamp, it's that same energy that went into an electron. So if it was a neon lamp, as long as the neon didn't kink out of it, it should last forever as long as electricity is going. be careful with your order of operations when you're doing 1 over n squared minus 1 over n squared. You might need some parentheses in your calculator. Or whatever. No, that's what it was for. Numbers get so strong.
No, that just says that it's a small one.
But didn't correct in the blank notes. If you were to look back at the other place that we have h, it's a different exponent. N to the minus 34.
Oh,
so that's why you were getting such a weird wavelength. So if you can recalculate that and get a more reasonable value. this value for energy of a photon? 3.03 times 10 to the minus 19? Okay. Now if we use the correct value of H, E equals HC over lambda, so lambda equals HC over E. Ten to the minus 34. Everybody get something in nanometers now? It's a little better. What'd you get? Three sig figs.
657.
Anybody confirm that? I got 656, but I might have put a rounded value in the denominator here. So, when you divide by the actual real value here, is that what you did, John? Or did you divide by rounded one? Okay, you kept them in?
Yeah.
And it rounded to 657? I think that's what it probably should do. I said, mine says 656, but I see that I used divided by 3.03 to the minus 19. So, if I divide by a number that's a little smaller, it should make that a little bigger. So, I think 657 is actually correct. If you got 656, I wouldn't be too upset with that. That's like orange red light. Remember, this is hydrogen. So we saw one particular transition that gives off orange red kind of colored light. Let me go back to last time. Page with atomic emission spectrum. Here, I zoom way in on this. For hydrogen, take a look at this. It gives off three pretty distinct lines, one fourth that's pretty faint. But look at this one. That looks orange-red, right? The existence of this line, of this wavelength of light that's given off, comes specifically from an electron making a transition from the third level down to the second level. Where do the other ones come from? Let's see here. Let's go to this page. How about if we go to the next picture that we have right here? Hey, look at this number right here. That makes sense, right? 3 to 2 gave us red. 4 to 2 gives blue-green. Why would that be? Why would it? So, more energy or less energy in the 4 to 2 transition? More energy? Okay. If I go from red to blue, right, what has more energy, red light or blue light?
Blue light.
Blue light does, right? And as a shorter wavelength, because as we go towards violet, we're getting closer to ultraviolet and X-ray and gamma ray, those really short, really high energy rays. So this right here, that's the whole reason those different colors given off by a gas sample are in existence. And for hydrogen, at least, we can very easily calculate those. Now, these are not the only transitions, but these are the only transitions that, what? These ones here are the only transitions in hydrogen that give off visible light. Okay? There's, I guess, probably one transition that gives off lower energy. So 2 to 1. Any guesses as what kind of radiation 2 to 1 would give off? What's beyond red? Infrared. Okay? So 2 to 1's in the infrared. Okay? If I went from 3 to 1, 4 to 1, things like that, those are going to be more energy than violet, or 5 to 2 is violet, but 5 to 1 or bigger drops like that would be ultraviolet and beyond. Yeah, it can, but this is actually not to scale here. If I go to the, yeah, believe it or not, a picture of an electron is not to scale. Here. If I go to this one over here that we had on our page, this one is actually a lot more closer to being at scale. The energy levels get much closer together. So I was actually fooling myself from that picture there. 2 to 1 is actually a bigger transition than 3 to 2 or even 4 to 2 is. Okay? The levels get closer and closer and closer and closer and closer together, the higher energy it is. So the single largest drop between two consecutive energy levels is between 2 and 1. Okay? But it just so happens that the ones down to 2 are just in that right window to give off visible light. Okay? Larger ones give off more powerful ultraviolet. Shorter ones give off infrared and so on. Okay? Does that make sense to you guys? So this equation right here, that and the single one. So those two equations will be given for you, as well as the variations of the wave and particle equations, but you should be prepared to do a calculation like that. Now, I'll give you a warning about mastering chemistry. Mastering chemistry uses a very similar equation to this, but instead of this single variable here, they've got a couple of other things. They have an equation that's 1 over lambda equals a different variable in there. So if you want to go through and use the other variables, it's a couple more steps. You'll get the same answer. Or you could just use this one that's in the book, which is easier. Okay? So don't be confused by the different equation that it gives you in mastering chemistry. It's all the same thing. It's just a matter of which constant you're using, whether you're solving for delta E or whether you're solving for 1 over lambda or something like that. Okay? It's all the same thing. It's just slightly different forms, but doing something like this will get you the exact same answer. Okay, does that make sense? Oops. Yeah.
So you can use this equation instead of the one they tell you to use.
They're two versions of the same thing, just more steps sometimes. If you want delta E, this is the simplest way to get it. Okay. All right. Any questions? All right. So that was just a little quick demonstration of what n, the principal quantum number, can tell us. Okay? Remember, it says we used it here for energy of an electron, and all you need is n to see the energy of an electron in a hydrogen atom. Okay? But let's go on to the next quantum number. So lowercase script l, like that, it's called angular momentum quantum number. In mastering chemistry, I saw there's one question that refers to it as the azimuthal, azimuthal quantum number. That's the old-fashioned name for it. Okay? So if you see that in mastering chemistry, it's referring to the same thing. But both of them have this little lowercase l by that. Okay? So angular momentum quantum number determines the shape of the orbital. Okay, so different lowercase l's will give orbitals that have different shapes. And remember, one definition of an orbital is a three-dimensional region inside of which an electron could be found. So l, again, they're integers, but l starts at 0. N started at 1. The first principal quantum number was 1, so the lowest energy electron was in n equals 1. Okay, but L starts at 0, it goes up 1, 2, and so on, until we get to n minus 1. So the maximum value of L depends on what our value of n happens to be for that electron. So if we are, so we'll talk about that in a second, but just as a little key here, there are sort of two, so L has numerical values, right? 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, like that. There are also letters, though, that are given that designate those same things, and we're going to be using these letters quite a bit as we're designating different electrons and so on. So just remember S, P, D, F, and after D and F, it's alphabetical, so G, H, and so on. Okay? But an S orbital is spherical. Okay? I have a feeling that's where the S letter came from. So here's a picture of an S orbital, or a representation of an S orbital, a sphere, just like a basketball or something like that. That just says that there's a probability of finding an electron somewhere within this sphere, and a lower probability of finding one outside of that sphere. Okay? No, everything within the sphere. The surface itself is just an artificial boundary. So we could say that there's a 95% chance of finding an electron within this boundary, something like that. Maybe a 98% chance of finding one in a larger boundary, or a 99% chance of finding a larger, so on. Okay? So depending on what probability we're talking about, we could define that surface differently. So S is spherical. P has two lobes. It's a common misconception to think that one electron goes in each lobe, but each of these lobes consists of the area that any electron could be in. So I could talk about one electron. That one electron could be anywhere inside of here or inside of here. Okay? That's, you know, think of it just like the sphere, except it's now two areas, but the electron could be anywhere within those. And remember, electrons can sort of disappear and reappear. It could be, we could think of it over here for a bit and then over there for a bit. That's really weird when thinking about particles, but not so weird when you think about waves, right? If you think about an electron as a wave, if that was a standing wave that had an up part and a down part, okay, it could be, you know, the jump rope kind of thing. It could be going up and down like that, but stay steady at the middle. Okay? It's called a node, a point where a wave isn't moving. So if you think of that one electron as a wave, it could be going up and down like that, but just have no possibility of being right in the very middle of it. Okay? So as L gets bigger, okay, and we continue on to other orbitals, they get more complex in shape. Okay? So D orbitals are clover-shaped, at least 4 out of the 5 are clover-shaped, where an electron could be anywhere within these little petals. F, it gets more complex. That's just one example of an F orbital. Some of them have all kinds of lobes to them. Some of them have, you know, rings moving around them. Can we pay attention over here, please? I mean, if you guys don't want to pay attention, that's fine, but, you know, the other people around here want to be listening, okay? So, So F orbitals can be very complex. There are several different shapes to them. So you do need to know that S's are spherical, P's are have two lobes, and sort of dumbbell shaped like that. D's usually look like clovers, okay? And it gets more complex as it goes on. But the general trend here is that we get more of these lobes as L increases. So let's go back to this idea that the possible values of L that we can have are limited by the first quantum number that we're talking about. Okay? So if, and we call those subshells, so if we're talking about the first N, okay, the first principal quantum number, like that first energy level that we had on the last page, there's only one possible value of L. Right? L can start at 0, but it can only go as high as n minus 1. Okay? If n equals 1, n minus 1 is 0. So only one possible value of L. So if we have an n equals 1 quantum number, we can only have a L equaling 0 We call that a 1S subshell because the letter we gave to that first L was S, and it's a spherical orbital. So I'm just going to draw a picture here. Just draw a little circle like that. That's a picture of what a 1S orbital will look like. This 1 right here is N. The S is the orbital shape. Okay? That's the only possible way that an orbital can look if N equals 1. Let's move on. If N equals 2, we could start with L at 0. Okay? That would be a 2S subshell. What shape would a 2S orbital look like?
Spherical.
Yeah, it'll be spherical, but how will it be different from 1S? Yeah. Remember I said the N changes energy, and it also changes what?
Size.
Okay? So we started with N equals 1. That was smaller. N equals 2 will be larger. But still spherical. Okay. Okay. But now, in N equals 2, okay, S is not our only available shape. Okay. What's the other shape that we could have?
Two-lobed.
Yeah, we could have a two-lobed orbital. Okay? We could have L equaling 1. We could have what's called a 2P subshell. Okay? It's going to look like two lobes. Yeah.
How does L equal 0 when
N is 2? Remember, L has all possible values starting at 0 going up until N minus 1. Okay, so there are all those options available to you. So if I had a huge N, I could have L equals 0, 1, or 2, or 3, or 4, or 5, and so on. Okay? So, but now, this is as large as we can get with L, right? Because in N equals 2, our maximum value of N of L is N minus 1. So that's it for the shapes in the second principal quantum number. So go ahead. There will be both, actually. So an atom doesn't have N equals 2, but an electron does. Okay. So if I have an N equals 2 electron, it could have L equals 0, or it could have L equals 1. L equals 0 is lower in energy, okay? So it will choose to have whatever is lowest in energy. But as we'll see in a little bit, those can become occupied, and then we have to start filling the next high, the next lowest energy one. Okay, go ahead.
Just to reinforce this picture.
Yeah.
If N equals 4, then L can equal 0, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, that's right. Oh. Yeah. If N equals 6, L could be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. Okay? So, that's it for N equals 2, though. If I move N equals 3, okay, and it's sort of backwards. We draw high energies kind of going up sometimes, but let's look at it this way as, well, in general, I'm actually not going to write that. Let's forget that. I was going to say higher in energy, but we'll talk much more about that on the next page. Okay. So what is the first available L that we could do for N equals 3? 0. What would I call that subshell using this sort of notation up here? 3S. And what would 3S look like? Yeah, a sphere that's larger yet than 2S. We're not going to draw all of these out, but we could have N equals 3, L equals 1. That would be called what? 3P. That would be two lobes, but larger than this one. What would this one be called? be 3D. Okay? That's the first occurrence of the clover-shaped orbital. Okay? Can I go any farther in N equals 3? Nope, that's it. Let's just write the N equals 4. Okay? For 0, for 1, for 2, and for 3. Right? What are the names of these ones? Start with 4 and 0. What's that one called? 4S? Okay, 4S, then what? 4P? 4D? 4F. Okay. For each N, there are N number of subshells. Okay? So N used to just be called a shell. That was back in Bohr model where the electrons were circling around just like planets. And there used to just only be shells. So first shell, second shell, third shell, and so on. Okay? The next thing that was discovered, though, was that those shells are broken into subshells, like we have here. Okay? So each shell has N number of subshells. What does that mean? N equals 1 just has this one place for electrons. Okay? N equals 2 has these two different subshells. N equals 3 has those three. N equals 4 has four of them. N equals 6 will have six different subshells, and so on. Okay? So N determined what two things? What does N?
Energy
and size. Okay? Increase N, we increase energy and size. Okay? L determines what? Shape. Okay? Shape, and there are subtle energy differences between those, but N is the primary determiner of energy. Okay? For instance, these subshells will be slightly different in energy, okay? Where I can say within these ones at least that L equals 3 will have higher energy than 2, than 1, than 0, so on. So of all of these N equals 4 subshells, 4s has the lowest energy. So if an electron has to be N equals 4, and if it had its choice between all those, it would choose 4s. Okay? If 4s was not available or full, for instance, it would choose 4p. Okay? That make sense? All right. So, next quantum number. We've done two so far. Okay. N was energy and size. L was shape. Okay. What the shape is. Our next one is the magnetic quantum number. Okay. Last one was angular momentum. This one is magnetic. Okay. So it's called M sub L. Okay. What would be very helpful to you would be on a blank piece of paper, make a chart that has these names and symbols and what they represent. Okay? That's going to be helpful to you when you're learning these things. Okay? So, magnetic defines the orientation of individual orbitals within a subshell. Okay? The reason I didn't call each of those subshells just orbitals is that some of those subshells can contain multiple orbitals. Okay. And an orbital itself is the actual shape inside of which there are electrons. Okay. So, again, the possible values of this one depends on what value we've chosen for the previous quantum number. So, this can go integers negative L to positive L. Okay. So, let's just take this sort of one step at a time here. We started with 1 and 0. We called it 1s. Okay. If L is 0, going from negative 0 to positive 0 is just 0, okay? Only one possible value of M sub L, so that means there's just that one spherical orbital, and that's it. Okay? So this one here, M sub L, shows us how many orbitals there are within those subshells. So we're starting broad, we're categorizing and dividing as we go along. Okay? So in the 2s subshell, okay, that's n equals 2, it's spherical, okay? Again, L is 0, so we only have that one orbital, okay? Any S subshell only has one orbital. Does that make sense? That S shape was defined by L being 0. And since we go from negative L to positive L, 0 is the only one of that orbital within that subshell. Now, when we get to P, remember what does P look like? Two lobes. Okay. Now that L is 1, my values for magnetic number are minus 1, 0, and plus 1. Okay. That means there are 3 orbitals within that subshell. Okay. So let's just go forward a page. We'll come back to that. But here they are. Every S subshell has a single spherical orbital. Every P subshell has 3 dual lobed orbitals, and they're arranged in different directions, okay? Like the 3 three-dimensional axes, okay? The x-axis, y-axis, and z-axis. So here's one of them, that's px, okay? Here's one py coming out towards you, okay? Here's pz going up and down. So those exist in the same space, okay? We just have them next to each other so you can see them here, but within the same space, okay, something like that, and one coming out towards you, going back. Okay? Okay. All of this consists of, I'm not going to draw a circle, I guess. All of this is a P subshell. Okay. Every P subshell exists as a grouping of 3 of those orbitals. Okay. So whether it's 2P or 3P or 4P, so it's those groupings of 3 like that.
We have a small P subshell. The larger ones, do they coincide with those?
They,
if you take the first P orbital as the P subshell,
mm-hmm.
the first P orbital of the second P subshell, would that be the same?
It'd be the same orientation, just larger.
Okay.
All of these orbitals we're talking about are actually superimposed, with the nucleus being at the middle of that. Okay? So, I mean, there's a reason we started drawing atoms with the electrons going around them like that, because you can actually see the places where electrons are. It's much more difficult to be drawing overlapping orbitals. Here's an S, there's 3 Ps, there's a bigger S, there's 3 more bigger Ps, another S, some more Ps. Lots of D's, it's all overlapping. But if we think about one of them at a time, right, which is useful for us, they look like this. Here is just one individual P orbital at a time, but there are 3 per group. That one. Okay? So let's do this for, we don't need to do it for all the rest of them, but let's do it for n equals 3. What is the lowest L in n equals 3? 0. The name of that subshell is 3s. Possible values for ml? 0. Number of orbitals? 1. Okay, so there's going to be 3-1 and 3-2. We called those 3p and 3d. Right? Possible values for ML for 3P are what? Minus 1, 0, plus 1. So there are how many orbitals in 3P?
3.
Possible values for ML for 3D start at what? Minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. So there are how many D orbitals in a subshell? 5. Okay. Remember what I told you the d orbitals sort of look like? They sort of look like clover shapes. I have pictures of them on the next page here. Oh, before we go here, how do we go negative 2? Look at the possible values for m sub l. Integers minus l to plus l. Okay? If n is 3 and l is 2, here's our l, we can go minus l to plus l. Okay? So, these are the 5 d orbitals. Okay? And I told you 4 of them are clovers. Okay? So, 4 corresponding, 3 will correspond with planes where the lobes are in between the axes. So the vertical one, the sideways one, and the horizontal one. This one is different because it has lobes on the actual axes themselves, on the x-axis and y-axis. Okay? So it is just rotated a little bit from this one. Where one of those had lobes in between the axes, this one will have lobes on the axes. And then, look at the last one. Look at dz squared. It has 2 lobes and a little hula hoop, a little donut thing around the middle of it. So, strange, strange stuff. But that's the interesting part about these, about the equations. So, the wave function of a particular atom, if you solve it for a d orbital, the solution will be a geometric formula that defines one of these shapes. Okay? It's a very complicated formula, but you can plug a different value in, and the answer will be one of these things. If you had it in a computer program or something, you could plug a different value in. It would give you an equation for a 3-dimensional shape, and it could graph it just like that for you, and you'd get something like that. That's where these things come from. Okay? So, but again, these have actually been confirmed by some amount of experimentation. We cannot actually see these shapes, but we can see that certain electrons have more electron density in this place and in that place, okay, which would coincide with a 2-lobed orbital. In the set of d orbitals, there's a little bit extra electron density around the middle that comes from that little donut in one of those orbitals there. So that's it for the threes. If I just quickly write the fours, remember now there are 4 of them. O, 1, 2, and 3 for S, for P, for D, and for F. Okay. We won't write these ones out because they're the same as what we had here, but let's do 4F. What's the lowest possible value of m sub l for 4f? Negative 3. Yeah, all the way to 3. So how many f orbitals are there? 7. So in any subshell that involves f orbitals, there are 7 of them superimposed. Okay? So let's just summarize right here. In any s subshell, how many orbitals are there? Just one spherical orbital, that's it. And that should make sense to us, because how many different ways are there to orient a sphere? You can turn it like that, but it's still a sphere. Okay. So, what about P? How many orbitals are there? 3? 3? Yeah. D? 5? F? 7. Okay. So it goes up sort of by odd numbers, like that. Okay. If I know the first 3 quantum numbers, I can define an orbital. Okay. The first one, n, is what 2 things again? Size and energy. Okay. L, shape. And L, they are different a little bit on energy. Slight differences in energy between the L's. Okay. M sub L tells us what? Orientation? Yeah? Okay. All of the individual orbitals within a subshell have the same energy. Right? So. So, if all I have is one electron that needs to go in any of those, there we go. Pretend I have just one electron that needs to go in any of those p orbitals. It'll be random as to which one it actually lands in. Same with these d orbitals. Okay. So, if I were to throw out a set of three quantum numbers, you should be able to at least say if those are valid quantum numbers or not. Okay? It's possible to have a set of invalid quantum numbers because we have very specific criteria for the values of quantum numbers. And you should be able to describe maybe what that orbital is. You don't need to know necessarily which direction, although each of these individual ones correspond with a certain value of m sub l. Minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2, so on. Okay. If I gave you something like 2, 1, and 3, is that a valid set of quantum numbers? Going in order. Let's start with n. N equals 2. We can have that, right? Yeah, we can have n equals 1 to anything. Okay. If we have n equals 2, can I have l equals 1? Yes. Okay. That shows us that it is a 2p orbital. Okay. In my 2p subshell, my set of 2p orbitals, can I have ml equals 3? What are our conditions for ml? Negative L to positive L.
Negative 1 to 1.
Yeah, I can have negative 1, 0, and 1. Is 3 a valid number for that? It is not.
But you can have p orbitals.
I can certainly have p orbitals. Yeah. 2 and 1 define this set of p orbitals. Okay. The third number will tell us which of those p orbitals we're talking about. Okay. Minus 1, 0, and plus 1. Likewise, if I have a set of d orbitals, okay, my first two will tell us that I have a certain set of d orbitals. My last number, ml, will tell us which of the d orbitals we're talking about, which are the specific ones. Okay? So in that case, I could go from minus 2 to plus 2, so any number between those would be valid. Okay? Is that a valid set of quantum numbers?
Yes.
Yes. That would be the, right? What letter of a subshell would this be? Here shows us it's 5, what? F? 0, 1, 2, 3, right? It's 5F. Okay? And there are 7 of them, so that shows us that this is the 6th of 7, because I can go from negative 3 to positive 3. Right? So, this is an okay. Yeah. Does that make sense to everybody? All right. Let me just show you one thing from start of chapter 8, and we'll. I had these notes put up around noon today. If you don't have them, it's not a big deal. We'll just talk from this page, but have this printed out for next time if you don't have it. Chapter 8 goes right along with chapter 7. In fact, a lot of the other books have these two just as one chapter. So we're not shifting gears at all, going from 7 into 8. What 8 does is take those things that we knew about orbitals and energy and places electrons can go and applies that to the actual elements on the periodic table. Okay? There's a whole reason that I'm telling you about 2s's and 4p's, and it's not just to memorize numbers and coordinates and stuff like that. It's because all of those can be used to predict properties, to explain why some things are reactive and why some things aren't, and so on. So an electron configuration, it shows which orbitals are occupied in an atom and how many electrons they contain. So hydrogen, of course, just has one electron. So we could show where that one electron is. But larger atoms have several electrons, right? Oxygen has 8, right? So an electron configuration will show where all of those 8 electrons are. Right? How many are in 1s, how many are in 2s, how many are in 2p, and so on. The ground state is the lowest energy, most stable state for an atom that has all electrons in the lowest energy possible orbitals. So remember, with hydrogen before, we saw that electrons could be promoted to higher excited states, but they would drop back down. Okay? So with one electron, the ground state is just the lowest energy level, just n equals 1. But with lots of electrons, you run into the issue where low-energy orbitals are filled. Right? We'll talk about capacity for electrons, but an orbital can only hold so many electrons. So the ground state will have all of the lowest ones filled as possible, and then only one above that's partially filled, if necessary. Okay? If there are ever multiple partially filled orbitals, that's usually not the ground state. Okay. Just before we go, answer me a couple of questions here about hydrogen. Okay. With hydrogen, remember, we only needed n to show the energy of an electron. Okay. So in its ground state, a hydrogen atom, okay, what's the lowest n? Lowest n is 1. Okay. Lowest L is 0. Okay. So lowest n is 1. Okay. In its ground state, that electron, so n equals 1, L equals 0, okay, what's that lowest energy orbital going to look like? Spherical. Okay? And what's it called? 1s. Okay? Its electron configuration is 1s1, where this little superscript up here is number of electrons in that subshell. For electron configurations, we do not separate out the first 2p and the other 2p and the other 2p, for instance. We just say in this whole 2p subshell, how many electrons are within those. Okay? So an orbital diagram, though, does show individual orbitals. So the orbital is a box. The electron, a little arrow in a box. I'll just draw an upwards arrow. I drew an upwards arrow because that's the last quantum number. Okay? The spin of an electron is sort of the directionality of the electron. You can think of it like a top can be spinning clockwise or counterclockwise. Now, the electrons themselves are not actually spinning around, but we can think of it that way. They have a magnetic moment that points in one direction or the other direction. So it's just a fundamental property of electrons that some have one spin and some have another spin. So that's the final quantum number, the MS, the spin quantum number. So plus 1/2 is an upspin, minus 1/2 is a downspin. Those are the only two possible values for the spin quantum number for an electron. Okay? So in particle physics, when they talk about other subatomic particles, bosons and fermions and stuff, those things can have different spins. But electrons are either spin up or spin down. So because there are those two quantum numbers, okay, everything up to this point has defined an orbital. Okay, this last one tells us which electron in an orbital we're talking about. So if I have those possibilities, how many electrons will fit in an orbital? 2. I can have one up and one down. And that's it.
So there's like this spin kind of like all the charge on the electron itself. Maybe like a north and south pole.
Yeah, it's sort of like, yeah, you can think of it like that. Like a, either as it's either attracted to the north pole of a magnet or to the south pole of a magnet. What's that? Yes, yes, they can, but not spontaneous. They have to be provided energy, or they have to be provided a certain reason to do so. Sometimes when they're promoted up or dropping back down, there's spin region. But if they're just in a certain place, there's spin region.
Right,
but
the box is the first spot usually up there?
Mm-hmm. Yep, just by convention, we draw the first one as up. If I were adding a second electron in here, I would draw a downwards arrow within that same box. Okay? All right. Let's go off to lab. We'll do lots more of this business next time.
Yeah.